I would like to acknowledge that this podcast meeting is being held on the traditional lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respect to elders both past, present and future, and to welcome you to this new episode for podcast Square Peg Round Hole. Welcome to Square Peg Round Hole, the podcast where we discuss diversity and how to embrace our neurodivergent kids at home, at school and in the workplace. Hi, it's Lou. I've been away for a while. If you've listened to my last episode where I interviewed Simone Wheatley-Hay, you'll know why. I was diagnosed last year with stage 4 lung cancer, having never smoked in my life, so everything's been turned upside down. This interview today, though, was one that I did already have planned before my diagnosis. And so because there has been so much interest in CPS, I thought it would be a good idea to go ahead with that interview. So I've made some time to edit it and to get the interview done. The interview is with Dr. Teresa Kidd and Dr. Miriam Kirby from Western Australia and of the Kidd Clinic. Both are clinical psychologists and both practice CPS. They practice it in their practice and also go into schools to work with some of their clients in the school setting utilising CPS. And that's what we discuss in this interview today. It's really good. I hope you enjoy it, and I'll try to be able to do some more if I possibly can. But my health is obviously number one priority. I don't want to overdo it. So I hope everyone's well, and I hope you enjoy this interview. Thanks so much. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Teresa Kidd and Dr. Miriam Kirby. Thank you so much for being here. I'm a little bit rusty, having had so long in between episodes, but I'm very, very pleased to have you both here today. There's been a lot of demand for you, so I'm glad you're here.
Thanks for having us on today, Lou. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. Did you use the word demand on purpose there, Lou?
I did think of it when I was saying it, and I thought, you know what, this chemo is starting to affect the way I talk, and my vocabulary is I'm saying, you know, puns that are not really intended. But anyway, yeah, let's talk about demanding. We demanded you be here today. So normally we start with some icebreaker questions, and as I'm interviewing both of you today, you can take turns. It's just a bit of fun, and it's just warming up the conversation. So the first one is about animals. What is your favourite animal and why? And you can go first, Teresa, if that's okay.
My favourite animal is a dog, many dogs. And we're known here in Perth at the clinic for being a bit of a dog clinic, because many of our clients and clinicians bring their dogs to the clinic. But, yeah, I have two little dogs myself. She's the Chihuahua and Kiki. And I just love the way that they are just so loyal and yeah, they greet me with enthusiasm, which my children don't always do when I walk in the door.
Don't I know it. And Miriam, what's your favourite animal and why is that your favourite?
Well, I've always grown up with cats, so I would have always said cats are my favourite animal. I just always used to love observing them, their aloofness and their quirky behaviours. But I actually now have a little dog called Teddy. Our family dog.
Cute.
And he's the size of a cat, so I feel like he's cat adjacent. So I still get
he is.
Yeah.
Is he an oodle?
He is an oodle. He's a cavoodle.
But oh, yeah, they're little.
A mini cavoodle. So,
well, yeah. The Cavaliers are beautiful dogs as well, so you did well there. Excellent. Okay, and then Teresa, back to you with the second question. If there was one thing you could change in the world, what would it be and why is that?
Well, it's quite relevant to the podcast, really, and that is for our young people to be able to have what they need. So, you know, in terms of education, but all different needs as well. So we know that there are many children growing up without getting their needs met. And, you know, that was the inspiration for our clinic here, is to help the children and their families in being able to get their needs more adequately met.
Perfect. Wonderful. Thank you so much. And, of course, we agree with that. And what about you, Miriam? If there was one thing you could change in the world, what would it be?
I think it's just that general concept of kindness and not assuming things about others from their outward presentation. You know, we can see, make judgments of other people from their, you know, what they present to us, but we never know what's really going on for others behind the scenes. So, yeah, kindness.
Yeah, I think it's something that we're all learning all the time. And it just keeps developing. You know, you have that inherent judgment inside you that you battle with, don't you? Yeah. Excellent. Okay. So now, again, a question for both of you, if that's all right. Can you tell us a little bit about your life, as much as you want to talk about who you are, you know, your life growing up and how you found yourself doing what you're doing today? Is there a connection between your background and your life and the square peg fitting into the round hole kind of concept?
I think definitely, like upon reflection, I think, you know, we have many members in my family who are neurodivergent in some way, and you know, quite a lot of mental health difficulties throughout our extended family and more immediate family. So I think I have always been interested in people and trying to understand people, and probably through my own lens of trying to understand other people as well. It's psychology was, you know, very interesting to me because I think that's probably been, you know, something that I've had of interest from a young age, is trying to work out other people and ways to be able to meet other people where they're at. So, yeah, since I started studying psychology, I just felt like I'd come home because it was, yeah, so interesting to me.
Yeah, great. Excellent. What about you, Miriam?
So I guess in terms of when I went to university, like I started off with my arts degree and I was interested in things like sociology and philosophy and history and psychology is the one that sort of held my interest, because I think it's just that, yeah, understanding people and also the science behind it. And then moving into my career, I guess my PhD was around reading disabilities, and just always seemed to have been interested in, you know, people who perhaps didn't fit into certain silos, like having worked in government departments before and you had four choices of where to put them, and that just never sat well with me. So I guess I've just been trying to find, yeah, my niche where I can, yeah, support those people who, yeah, don't fit into those silos and can offer them a really individualized kind of support that suits their needs, and try to advocate for them in different spaces and systems.
I've never worked for government before, but I've heard so many people say that sort of thing about the structure and the silos. I mean, even in the private corporate world, the silos just used to bug me so much. It's just not right. So, Miriam, I'm going to ask you this question. Can you please help us understand what is PDA? It's the topic of our discussion today. We really need to understand more about PDA, and particularly about whether it's a recognised diagnosis in Australia.
Right. So PDA stands for pathological demand avoidance, and it's a behavioural profile associated with autism. Many members of the autistic community prefer the letters to stand for pervasive demand for autonomy, because it's associated with an anxiety-driven need to be in control, and avoid other people's demands and expectations. And so I guess it's like your nervous system being on high alert all of the time, looking for threats to your sense of autonomy and control, unexpected demands. It isn't a diagnosis. There's no diagnostic criteria. It is being recognised as something to consider in the National Guidelines for Autism Diagnostic Assessments, in the National Guidelines. It's also been recognised by the National Autistic Society and I think the British Psychological Society and the Royal College of Psychiatrists in the UK also recognise it as a profile, but not yet as a diagnosis.
Okay, thank you very much for describing it. So we've got a good platform to explore PDA further. Teresa, my next question is for you. I have heard before that PDA is compared to ODD. So it's like PDA for autism and ODD for ADHD. Could you help us understand the difference and the implication of misdiagnoses between these two conditions?
Yeah, it's not sort of surprising that they can be misdiagnosed, or the PDA can be misdiagnosed as ODD, which is what happens more often, because there is an overlap between the two. So on the surface, you know, some of that those oppositional behaviours can look quite similar, but the roots are often quite different. So we know for many kids with a diagnosis of ODD, the roots might be more in childhood trauma or neglect or poor sort of parental boundaries. But we know for our PDAers, often parents are working really, really hard to try and understand their child with a PDA profile. They've done a lot of research. They're trying different ways of being able to parent their child, because it does take a different parenting approach. And also kids with ODD tend to be a bit more they may refuse more and be more oppositional, but don't show a range of social strategies for avoidance like PDAers might. So, and PDAers have different characteristics. They're not the main, even though it's called pathological demand avoidance, there are other characteristics of PDA on top of the avoidance. So we need to look at PDA as a whole profile. Avoidance is a very strong part of PDA, but there are other characteristics that we would look at when we're trying to identify whether a young person has PDA. And PDAers don't seem to be as aware socially, whereas young people with ODD, they are more aware of their peers and of acting in ways that are going to help them to assimilate with their peer group, whereas PDAs can have quite shocking social strategies, I guess, or social behaviour at times, and that's one of their avoidance strategies. The other thing that I sort of look at as well is that kids with ODD often respond really well to, you know, quite strong behavioural strategies and boundaries, whereas with kids with a PDA profile, it's often the opposite for them. So, you know, if people are very strict with them, then they're going to, you know, probably be more avoidant and comply less. And research has shown for kids with ODD, you know, a lot of those very more behavioural parenting strategies can work well in increasing their compliance.
I didn't realise there were such obvious differences. Do you find in your practice that you have to take a long time before you can really see that, or is it become quite obvious to you over time?
It depends on the profile, because what we have learnt is that, you know, some of our PDAs can mask really well. So they are really good at masking, or they've, you know, sort of been very used to masking. It can take longer for us to see that PDA profile. Some of our PDAs can come in and straight away we can just tell because we've worked with so many PDAs, and, you know, I've got a son with this profile. So, you know, I'd feel it and I can pick that up. But often we will say to parents, if parents come to us and they might say, oh, I think my child has a PDA profile, we'll often say, let's just work with your child. We'll listen to you, listen to their, you know, what's happening for them at school, but we'll get to know the young person. And I feel like over time we can see whether they do have that profile or not. So we're not quick to jump into saying a child has a PDA profile, because we really want to get to know them, because it might just be some initial anxiety or you know, some other difficulty that they're having. And so I think that, you know, taking, and we will say to parents, if you use the approach of the PDA approach, and that can often help parents to see whether it's made a difference in the way their child is at home. So if parents will start using strategies, and then they might see a difference, and we'll say, well, then it's more likely to be PDA because this approach is working much better for them.
Interesting. Okay. Wow. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more. I noticed you mentioned school there, and that's like a classic environment, isn't it, where things are triggered that we would like to avoid. My next question is about parents who may be thinking that their child might be a PDAer or may have a recent diagnosis of PDA, and they're kind of deer in the headlights. We all know what that feels like. What do you recommend for families so that they can access the right supports when they're in that situation?
Yeah, so hopefully parents have been working with a clinician who has a good understanding of PDA and is giving the parents a great psychoeducation about what it is and how it presents in their child. But I guess as clinicians, you know, we've learned a lot from lived experience of adults that are kind of sharing information either about them, their own experience of PDA or their children's lived experience. So people like Christy Forbes, for example, who share a lot through various channels. So we often kind of refer families to look at, you know, people in that area, as well as the PDA Society in the UK. There are a lot of resources. Mm-hmm. We also have set up some webinars and training that we share as well. But I think, yeah, first of all, it's understanding what it is, and it's a real shift in mindset, I guess, because like we've mentioned, there's a change in the parenting strategies that you might use and a change in how you're viewing the I guess behaviors of distress that you're seeing in your child, and just understanding it's coming from a place of anxiety. So we use a lot of trauma-informed kind of practices, keeping that in mind, rather than more traditional parenting strategies that are, I guess, based more on, you know, traditional behavior support philosophies. So yeah, I think there's a lot to take in, so for parents and making those adjustments. So I think, yeah, connecting with supports that understand PDA, it might be informal supports, but also working with clinicians to support the parents and work individually with the children or young person where appropriate, is the first step. And I guess there's some work to be done there around, you know, in terms of education and in helping advocate for what the young person needs at school, if they are in fact at school. Sometimes it involves changing that setup. So if mainstream education is not working, looking at alternatives.
Yeah. And so I have two questions that come from that in my head. One is, do you often find that, well, my first question is, what comes first, the chicken or the egg, the autism diagnosis or the PDA diagnosis? What do you find? Is it not, you know, the same for everybody? Or, you know, like, for example, my son, he's autistic. The autism diagnosis came very late. The ADHD came first, and you hear that a lot. And then we've just not received a PDA diagnosis or identification in any way. So obviously that's just not part of his neurological makeup, I guess. But what happens in that way? Does it tend to be one before the other, or I'm just interested?
I think generally the autism diagnosis comes first. And then I know that was definitely the case for me with my son, because I was running a lot of groups for autistic young people. And, you know, these young people were able to come along and participate in anxiety, you know, reduction sort of groups. And I would be thinking, gosh, there's no way that my son could ever come along and participate in a group like this. This is amazing. How come they can talk about their emotions and actually use, you know, these practical strategies to reduce their anxiety? And then occasionally we'd have someone that would come along to the group, and I would just recognize that they had a similar presentation to my son, and they wouldn't be able to tolerate being in the group, you know. So then I started to research about what this sort of atypical autistic presentation, I suppose, was, and why it was different. And that's when I read about PDA. So that was probably about 15 years ago now. And, you know, like many parents do, I did a deep dive into that area, and it helped so much. So I think, you know, once that is identified, I mean, we're already doing a lot of those strategies, I suppose, and my son wasn't attending school, so we hadn't had to sort of deal with the education side of things. But I think, yeah, it's just so helpful to know that you are doing the right, you know, you do have the right approach for your child, even though you might be being told that your child, you know, you're too soft on your child, or you should be stricter with your child, or have, you know, firmer boundaries. So I think, you know, just understanding that that profile is present, I think is so important, but it often does come after the autism diagnosis. So when parents come to us and they say, oh, my child's been to 3, 4, 5 schools, you know, then often that might be an indication to us that, oh, this isn't just autism. Or they might be talking about them at home and having really aggressive or violent, you know, sort of behaviours, and we'll just say, well, that isn't just general autism. So, yeah, there's it often does come afterwards, but sometimes parents are coming to us and their child hasn't had an autism diagnosis yet, yeah, and they're coming because they've read about PDA and they're like, does my child have to have an autism diagnosis to have this profile? Because it really sounds like them.
Yeah. I know a couple of people where that's happened that way, which is why I asked the question. And you almost answered the next question that I was going to ask, which is about the, I will use the word ableism in schools, and it's not directed in any negative way towards the teaching professionals, but my question to you is, how much of this well-meaning but very ableist approach that you often hear parents talking about from school, how much of a problem really is that?
I think it becomes a problem because it's not identifying the young person's individual needs sometimes. And so it really is that square peg round hole concept. Without kind of really understanding the child's needs and how their nervous system works and how they learn best and things like that. So I think that's where the concerns lies, yeah.
Right. I mean, how often do you hear a parent and a child coming to see you saying that, you know, when we know that the behaviour to a person who doesn't understand it appears to be extremely disrespectful and rude and oppositional and demanding and just all these things, that these words that are so ableist to what's really going on with that child. I mean, how often does a parent ever say to you, I had a teacher that really understood what was going on behind that, like you just said?
It does happen. Yeah, we are working with some, you know, some teachers and schools that really do get the profile, which is fantastic. And, you know, what we've been asked more and more frequently to present on PDA at schools. So that is good because the schools are starting to recognise the profile. It just depends on the particular teacher and how open they are to understanding the profile. And obviously they are supporting this child within a big classroom. So, you know, it is very difficult for all of the needs to be met. And, you know, when I talk to educators, I'll say, I'm asking you for a lot, and obviously you're not going to be able to do all of these things to help this young person feel safe and learn best in a classroom. But if you don't do any of them, or you don't do many of them, then you're going to lose them and they won't be at your school. So,
I love that. I love the way you've said it there, because I'm always really wary of getting the teaching profession offside, because I absolutely have the uttermost empathy for their role. It's obviously very difficult at times for them. So thank you. And I didn't mean for this to happen, but this question leads into the next one, which is about traditional behavioural approaches in schools, such as rewards and punishments, which we're now moving into CPS territory. But the question is around, and you've started to talk about, whether that would work well for the PDAs. Could you tell us a little bit about some helpful ways that you are working with people with PDA that don't involve the traditional behaviourist approach?
Well, I think the biggest thing that we work on, certainly in our role as clinicians, is to develop a relationship that's founded on trust and a really good core, because I think that's the key to assist with things like co-regulation, so using our nervous systems together to stay well regulated in our sessions, and hopefully, you know, generalize that to other settings over a period of time. We recognize that it takes time to build that trust, so we don't rush. We just take as much time as is needed. We also want to hear the young person's voice, so we want to be doing a lot of collaboration, because I guess collaboration does happen with our young people, but it's always seems to be around the young person, like all the other stakeholders in the young person's life might collaborate, but the young person's voice isn't necessarily there. Like, I guess the parents or clinician might try to, you know, share their voice, but it's really good to directly collaborate with the young person and hear from them. And I guess we're just building on that from that place of trust, collaboration, and just being really flexible with the way we work. So we understand that the young person's capacity is going to change depending on what else is going on, either externally or within their own body. So we know that, you know, what happened in one session, we won't get too excited that might happen the next time, because we understand it's going to be a different day. And just having that understanding of what's underlying some of the behaviours of distress that you see, it's rooted in that kind of, from that point of anxiety. It's not intentional misbehaviour. They're distressed, often on the verge of a panic attack, or, you know, having meltdowns, which are like having a panic attack.
Of course.
Just trying to really personalize things, try to use their interests, but being very selective about how we do that, because sometimes if it seems inauthentic, our young PDAs can sniff that
They're smart. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. And I guess, thinking about how we're going to give instructions, making things more indirect, or if there's something we might want to work on, I guess we can try to be as transparent as possible, but not necessarily give direct instruction. This is our agenda today, but we might just strew things around that we might want to work on or interact with together. So it's just a flow of interaction rather than a set agenda. It's good to have a structure. Like, it's still good for PDAs to have a structure, to know roughly what's going to happen in a session, in a day, because they still have challenges with uncertainty, but there needs to be flexibility in how things happen during the day, and I guess opportunities for them to opt in and opt out. So I don't know if you wanted to add to that, Teresa.
All of those, that's how we work in our sessions, but obviously we're only working with our clients, you know, for 50 minutes every fortnight, and, you know, we have got the luxury often of building that relationship just with that one person in the room. I think it is more challenging, you know, within a school environment, because teachers are not well resourced often, or, you know, schools are not well resourced or not well resourced enough to be able to really provide the individualised and personalised curriculum that PDAs often need within a school environment. So, but it can still happen, and we do have success for some of our PDAs in school. So we know those ingredients that can make up that recipe for success, but it's hit and miss, you know, depending on the school and the resources they have and the teacher that student has at that particular time. But it can be successful. We do have students that like going to school, and, you know, the teachers do understand their profile. They can be flexible, but it is a big, you know, it is difficult when teachers have 30 kids in their class and one with a PDA profile.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for the teachers it's difficult because they do have those 30 kids in their class, and they are absolutely stretched. And for us parents, that's our child speaking to us like that, and it is so hard. I mean, I fully admit it is so hard to not to remove yourself and just take a deep breath. It took me years to be able to do that. You know, it's an absolute skill.
Yeah, we always, you know, encourage parents not to take things personally, because, you know, it's not often our PDAs are not meaning those, you know, those hurtful words that they might say at the time. And it often is a sign that they are not feeling regulated. And so we really encourage parents to see it that the child or the young person is not in that, you know, social engagement zone at that time. They're not feeling that state of regulation. So then we need to think about what we can do to help them to feel safer and more secure. So it might be just changing it up, talking about interests, or you know, something that they enjoy talking about, or just sort of backing off, because we know that when they're speaking in that way, it's often that they're not feeling good.
Yeah, absolutely. And and those things do work, and you do get better at it. I agree. So now let's talk about PDA and Collaborative Proactive Solutions, or CPS. I understand that the Kid Clinic have been implementing CPS with some of the families that you work with. We're really excited to hear a bit more about that, especially given that Dr. Ross Green, the founder of CPS, is coming to Australia this year. We're gaining some traction with that. So very keen to hear what you've been up to.
We're very excited that Ross is coming to Australia. I did the training with him about four or five years ago when he was in Melbourne. And the reason that I did that training, I had read The Explosive Child when my son was younger, and it was helpful, but obviously that CPS, the Collaborative and Proactive Solution model, wasn't formed to the, you know, extent that it is now. So parents have been saying to me that they had started to use the CPS approach with their young people, their children or young adolescents, and they had found that it was the only parenting approach that had worked for them. And I know for me with my son, I went to a number of parenting courses when he was little, and I'd come to the weekly parenting course, and other parents would be saying, well, I said this to my child, and then my child said this back, and then we decided to do this and that. And I'd be thinking, gosh, you know, there's no way I could be having those conversations with my son. So, you know, you do have to try and think about what else, what other approaches you can take. So when parents started to say that they were using the CPS approach, I thought, well, I'll go and get trained in that model, because then maybe I can help to facilitate that for other families at the clinic. And I did, and I went through the certification process. So I'm the only certified person, I think, in WA currently, but most of, you know, many of our clinicians here have done his 2-day training, which is what he'll be doing when he comes to Australia. So highly recommend it. I think when many parenting strategies are based on behaviour and changing behaviour and use rewards and, you know, they're just not going to work for our PDAs. So we do need to look at something different, which is where CPS might be helpful.
I noticed on your website that you have a section there called problem solving sessions or something like that. Is that where you would do CPS?
No, problem solving sessions are just one-off sessions where families that may not be able to get in to see a clinician can have a one-off session, usually with Miriam or myself, and they can, often they're from people, you know, all over Australia where they can say, you know, I have a PDA or I think there might be PDA, and they're in a, or just they don't have to have a PDA profile, but, or school's not working, or, you know, I don't know what to do about this, or the anxiety's, you know, through the roof and it's interfering with this and that, and we will just try and, you know, come up with ways to be able to assist that family in that one session, and they can go away and try some of the things that we might recommend, and we might recommend other resources or just strategies
Yeah, I just thought from the name of it might be CPS, but so you just put CPS into your general you know, it's an option for people to start working that way. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So often families have already, you know, heard a little bit about it, or they might not have, and they might be just really hitting a wall in terms of their communication and relationship with their young person. So we might recommend that they give CPS a try.
Oh, great. Excellent. And you've had great success with it so far. You feel it's got a good place? Or do you? Or do you not?
Hard, like, you know, with our PDAs. So sometimes our PDAs may not be, you know, may not be able to tolerate being part of the collaborative proactive solutions.
Okay.
So it just depends, but definitely I find that parents have been using this model for some time. Like, they're young, even if the parents are just coming from that lens shift and are able to talk in the way of, you know, we're here to solve this problem together, right. I find that the young people can start to tolerate more and more those conversations. So it can be a bit more of a journey with PDAs. Like when Ross Green talks, he can go into a school and he's never met the teachers or the student before, but they can have a 40-minute session. He could do the whole, CPS model in that one session and walk away. We can't do that with our PDAs. They have to know us first. If we're going to be facilitating that, they need to feel safe in the clinic, and the parents need to be well-versed in how it works as well, so they can also use it at home. So for us, it's a longer process than you know, with kids that don't have a PDA profile.
If you had to compare the positive behaviour type approach or the ABA, I'm going to ask the question, or the ABA originated approach, rewards and punishment essentially, with a PDA person, young person, compared to CPS, tell me.
I think the CPS model sort of sits more with my personal values about how to support PDAers, and the reason is you can give rewards and punishment, but that it doesn't really change behaviour. I mean, I have met some PDAs who do like a tick chart and they do like a reward, but that's kind of their choice in a way. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I'm thinking, oh, that's, a little unusual for a PDA, but I have met PDAs who, will negotiate that on their terms, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Negotiation.
Yeah, they negotiate. Hours of
negotiation could also be called problem solving in a way. Yeah. Collaborative problem solving, I guess, you know, if that's what works, then anyway. Yeah, well, that's interesting. I kind of thought you might say that, but that's interesting that you are still seeing, you know, everyone's an individual, aren't they? Everyone's different.
Yeah, but I think this, like I was saying before, the CPS model just lets the young person be involved in saying, you know, what's going on for them around the problem, and learning some skills in, you know, working together with their parent or whoever, you know, they're trying to negotiate or collaborate with, to come up with solutions that are workable for both parties.
Yeah, and I think it's such a good lens, you know, shift, rather than this child's being naughty, how are we going to punish them for that? And we still do get asked that when we visit some schools, you know, or what are the consequences? They did this, what are the consequences? Yeah. Whereas I think if you're coming from that PDA lens, we're really looking at what are they having difficulty with? So I think if we come from it from that angle, then we're really trying to problem solve. Okay, so this is, you know, and if we can hear from the young person, I often have young people that come to me because they won't be talking to their school about things that aren't working for them at school, but they'll come to me and say, this boy sits next to me, he's really noisy and doesn't stop talking, or the teacher's really shouty, or, and so then I can just, you know, feed that back to the school. And they can make some changes, whereas the school might just be seeing, you know, the way this child's reacting because of those things that are going on in their environment.
And those enforced consequences lead you to believe that they may not really recognise that this child actually does have a disability, and kids do well when they can, not when they want to, as Ross says.
Yes.
Miriam, would you please expand a little bit more on what Teresa has started saying there about the work you are doing in schools? What is the response? What is kind of the most common type of objections or barriers that you find that you have to overcome? We're really keen to hear about the work you're doing with CPS in schools.
So sometimes through working with individual clients, we might be have an opportunity to go and consult with educators and give psychoeducation about the CPS model and sort of work through an individual case like that. And sometimes schools have invited us to come and support them with one of their individual students, again, like working through the CPS model. I think one of the barriers or perceived barriers is the time that it can take to kind of work through things like identifying the unsolved problems and really nutting that out, like what is the thing that we're actually going to work on. Because when you're looking at what the unsolved problems are and the lagging skills, we've kind of sometimes got to remove, like, plan C, some of the unsolved problems because of, maybe the expectations aren't reasonable of the young person at that time. So we've really kind of got to wade through. Like, I do admire that Ross can go in 40 minutes to sort that out, but I find that can take a little while. And sometimes you can get bogged down in the examples of behaviours of concern, I guess. Because we're so used to talking about the antecedents, what the behaviour looks like, what the consequences are. So we're just still used, and me too, that's how I was trained. So, yeah, just all of us trying to shift our lenses and just, okay, what are the expectations reasonable? Does the young person have capacity? If so, what are we going to name up the unsolved problem as being, and then take it from there, and then prioritizing, okay, what are we going to start with? I think that can be challenging too. Are we going to try something where we can get a bit of bang for our buck, or, you know, set it up for success, or are we going to start with a more meatier problem because it's an issue of safety? But that can sometimes be challenging.
And do you find that there are schools in WA anyway who you feel are really switching to CPS, or is it still too early for that? Are you really just working with individuals more?
I feel that there is a switch to taking this model on, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Are there certain schools, public, private sectors, is there anything you observe that where there's like a more amenable approach and that they're sort of more open to accepting this new model?
Well, in terms of the schools that I've already worked with, it's really across sectors, so it's not necessarily public versus private. I don't know if you have any experience.
I think it's and I know when I did the training there were quite a few people from WA at the training, and they were school psychologists and also educators, so I think it's just about, if there's one person in the school that learns about the model, then it might be something that becomes a bit more, taken on more broadly within that particular school. So, we really hope that more schools do start to learn about this approach. And we certainly talk about it in every single training we do at schools, just so that they can just plant the seed and hopefully they can just start to look at it themselves and think about whether it could be something they could take on as a school. It's used so widely in schools in the US, and not just in schools, it's used in, you know, juvenile detention centres, if you like. I know Ross, where he lives, he said that there were two really full juvenile detention centres. And when they took on the CPS model, that one of them closed down completely and the other one, it was less than half full. So that was using that model, which I thought was just so powerful. Yeah, so it just shows, you know, the shift that can happen in terms of all kids, not just, you know, neurodivergent young people.
I know I need all the education systems here to hear that exactly from him. I really, really hope we can put him in closer contact with those who can understand this sort of concept and what that can do. That is phenomenal. A whole school, a whole youth detention centre. I didn't know that. Sorry, Miriam, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, just, you know, having the opportunity to work with those individual schools and hopefully get the groundswell effect.
Yes.
So sometimes we're just working on one individual student. I just feel like that psychoeducation and the work around changing lenses kind of gets people thinking, and they can start to apply and generalize their knowledge with the students that they work with. And I've just been really impressed with the schools that we have worked with, that they do kind of get key people to come to those sessions where we're consulting on students.
Well, let's hope it's like a snowball effect. And Ross did actually, when I interviewed him last year for the podcast, he did actually talk about the exact sort of process that you have outlined there as well. It only takes one person and it only takes a book review of Lost at School, and it can go from there. As long as there's a will, there's a way to do it. So hopefully that will start to happen even more and more. And now I wanted to ask you a bit more about the CPS model. I'm wondering, particularly in regards to a child who is a PDAer, how CPS can work if that child is completely unable to engage with the adult to solve the problems together. What do you do? You've alluded to it a little bit, but what do you do if a PDAer in front of you just says, no way, I'm not engaging with this at all?
May have had that happen. May have had things thrown at me in a couple of Plan B sessions.
Righty ho! So tell us what happens.
Oh, what do you do when someone's throwing stuff?
Well, obviously, it's a big demand for that young person, and it may be that they don't have capacity. And I actually laughed with one of my PDA clients the other day. With her dad, who'd picked her up from session, and we spoke about that first time when I met her, and she was throwing things at her dad's head and towards me in the room as well. And she's come a long way since then. And we have worked not in such a formal way with the CPS model, but definitely used it in terms of advocating for her in her schooling setting, in her school settings. And also, you know, I think that's helped her to be able to see that these problems that do come up can be solved. So, you know, just by us working with her and the way the parents, you know, and that, I guess, because her parents knew about CPS and, you know, see her through that lens as well, and what she does through that lens, and as do I, you know, I think it's given her the confidence to be able to advocate for herself as well. You know, sometimes that comes through me, but also in terms of that she knows that, you know, these difficulties can be solved. It's just amazing. But,
Great.
I guess sometimes, if they're not ready to do the Plan B, it might be that, you know, they're not yet well regulated, like if they've been in a period of autistic burnout, or, you know, they've had traumatic experiences at school, they might still need time to kind of work through that before they're ready to do like a CPS problem solving session, just because of the heightened demands that involves. I guess once they're feeling that, you know, they can trust the clinician, or they're able to kind of work well in communicating with their parents, then we could bring it in. But I think that it really does have to be a meaningful issue or problem for the young person. So just kind of being curious if the parents have identified an unsolved problem, but the young person doesn't resonate with that, they're not really interested in getting on board to discuss that. Maybe we can sort of try to unpack why that is, or is there another problem that is important to both the young person and the parent that they kind of, they might be more willing to nut it out in those circumstances if the young person is more invested in the problem and possible solutions that would be of benefit to them.
It's important, obviously, to have the proper training to know what to do at those times, I'm sure.
It's very specific. I mean, parents can definitely, you know, be trained in the model as well. But when I went through the training, I must, you know, it took me quite a bit of work on my part. We had to do recordings of sessions and send them in, and they would be analyzed. And that's not the 2-day training. This is when you go through the certification process, because the wording is so particular and it has to be so specific of the area of difficulty that you're going to be talking about with the young person. So I think, definitely. Ross has got some great, as you would have known already when you spoke to him probably in your podcast earlier, but he has a lot of free resources on his site, videos where parents can watch those and educators can. But yeah, his training I think is quite foundational in just being able to, and I know when I did it in Melbourne in the in-person training, there was a lot of practical, you know, we could practice on, you know, with someone else. And so, you know, all of that helped you to gain skill in being able to have a plan B session.
Also, it's okay to plan C a lot of things. Like, I think sometimes parents are worried, oh, if we're just, you know, parking everything, we're not really working on anything. But it is okay, to use plan C, knowing that that's temporary and you're going to get to those things eventually, or some of them at least. And that you can still, you know, if you're not doing a plan B session, you can still have family guidelines or non-negotiables that you can try to establish within your family, which are around health and safety. So maybe prioritizing things like that, and then keep resourcing the young person to be able to participate in the plan B sessions.
That's really important to say too, I'm sure, because those who are skeptical before they've had that lens shift and that mindset shift may be forgiven for thinking it's permissive, too permissive, rather than seeing that it's actually not throwing everything out the window. There are guidelines that need to be followed as well, and it's not just, you know, free for all.
Exactly. Our children still need to feel held, you know, so they still do need to, you know, feel a sense of boundary and safety and feeling held, so they come from that secure place when they're going, you know, either at home or out into the world. But it can sometimes seem to people who are more behavioralist in their approach that, you know, parents are just letting their child get away with everything. But, you know, with the CPS model, the focus is only usually on three, you know, lagging skills, and usually I need just work on one with a family at a time, because, you know, the capacity of the young person is usually less if they're neurodivergent, I find.
I can't wait for it to just be spread amongst the whole of society more, so that the world can change around the square pegs to fit the square pegs. I have a final question for you both, because we've been talking for probably long enough now. I ask everybody this question who comes on the podcast, because I think that you are all such experts and get your information from places where you feel, you know, you're going to value that information. Can you tell me about any mentors or resources? Please also include your own work and your own, I'll obviously link your website to this in the show notes, but any particular experiences or mentors or resources that you can recommend to parents and teachers who will be listening to us today?
So on this topic, in terms of PDA, I guess, my starting point was things like PDA Society and any trainings on the topic that I could do, and copious book buying on the topic.
Yeah. Any particular books that have really grabbed you?
I've read. I actually love. I think it's by Eliza Fricker. It's a really small book, and I can't think of the title. But it's Family Experience of PDA, because I just think it's really accessible, because it's not too thick. It's quite succinct, and it's got really good illustrations. Illustrating the point.
Oh, great.
One standing out in my mind is something I've read recently.
Thank you. That's brilliant. Thank you. Anything else you want to add?
I was just thinking in terms of the books as well, one that I tell lots of schools about is the one by Phil Christie. He's a clin psych, and Ruth Fidler, and it's called something like Collaboration in Schools or something. That's not the title, but it's just a small book as well. But it has lots of good templates in there for personalising curriculum, ways of being able to collaborate on demands that might occur in the school day. So I think, you know, if parents are listening and school is difficult for their PDA, then that might be a good book to buy the school or get the school to purchase.
I've done that before, bought a book for school to help them to sort of try and change the way they're thinking. That's great.
There's also a few for young people. Like there's the smaller picture books. One's called Pretty Darn Awesome. I quite like that for young people if they're interested in reading about PDA.
It sounds very strength-based. Pretty Darn Awesome.
Like that.
And on our website, we do have a few webinars that we've recorded over the past year, and there is one for teachers on there as well. So, we've recorded that Mira and I did with Janelle Fraser, and she's a neurodivergent education consultant. So,
Janelle, yes, I know her. Great.
So, that might be valuable. We recommend that for schools to watch if they are new to PDA or trying to work out how to help our young people within school settings.
Fantastic. I'll put a link to that as well. Definitely. That's awesome. Thank you. Anything else or you think?
It would be great to mention about Ross Green. So
yes,
if people do want to know about his training, please feel free to go to our website and join our mailing list, because we will be sending out information about the training. We're bringing him to Perth, and we're working in conjunction with Illume Learning, who are bringing him to all of the other states, or not all of the other states, but many other states in across Australia, and I think maybe even New Zealand. So, if you join our mailing list, then we can send you the information about the various trainings that will be happening in September this year.
Yes, September. Excellent. Oh, I didn't realise that you were bringing him to WA. So you poor things in WA, you're all the way over there.
I know. It's the first time he's ever been to Perth, so he's very excited.
Oh, is he? I just had a friend from the UK in Perth literally a few weeks ago, and she said, there's no one here. She thought it was completely empty, but she loved it and went to Rottnest Island and everything. So are you gonna show him around?
Well, I hope to, but it will be a bit of a flying visit, because he's doing a tour of the whole of Australia. So I think he's only here for 3 days, and two of those days will be the training. So we'll have him working pretty hard while he's here.
Oh, man, you've got to feel sorry for him, don't you? I mean, I did the same thing. I wrote to him and said, oh, my goodness, the whole country is buzzing that you're coming.
It's so exciting.
Yeah, we're very excited. Yeah. Oh, that's great. All right, well, let's I guess sign off, because I think we're just under an hour, so that was very clever of me. Thank you both so very, very much for being here today. I'm sure this is going to really help many parents and teachers who have been asking the question about those three letters PDA. Thank you again, and we look forward hopefully to meeting in person one day.
That would be wonderful. Thank you so much, Lou.
Thanks, Lou.
No problem. Acknowledgements. Thank you to Carla Cushell of Carla Cushell Creative for the podcast logo and the website. Images and episode quotes are the work of Jazzy C. Music is also by Jazzy C. Finally, a big thank you to my friends and family for encouraging me. As always, thank you to my partner in everything, Ash Cushell. And remember, just be nice to one another.